High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
This is Majority Rights Radio. Our guest is Norman Lowell, the writer and politician. Good morning, Mr. Lowell.
Good morning to you, Mr. Renner. I would be pleased if you call me Lowell straight away. It's simple and direct.
In that case, symmetrically, you ought to call me Renner.
Renner. Okay, greetings from Malta, Renner, and listeners to Majority Radio.
Greetings, Lowell. Most of the questions this week originate with the Majority Rights Commentariat. Thank you for your time and efforts on our behalf. What can the above-average man do to bring about a change for the better?
Well, the average man can do average things. In my view, we are in a battle, all of us. This 5% biological aristocracy, which is the European race. And the problem is that too few are in the fight. The rest are that herd of bisons, you see, masticating chewed cud, as we say. So every little helps. One could write a letter to the press, to the papers, to the village newspaper or newsletter, whatever. One can give support to some local group which is in this fight. One can do a lot of things. One can send some money to worthwhile, let's call them nationalist groups at this point in time. So every little helps because... let's face it, we are 1 billion, you see. There are 1 billion of us. And if only a majority of us, thus his little bit, we could rule the world, actually.
You have previously stated that 2012 would be the year one of the coming Imperium Europa.
Yes.
Given that it is now 2007 and that the forces of anti-white, anti-Western and anti-nationalist globalism are stronger than ever, while nationalists are no closer to power than before. Don't you think that 2012 is ludicrously overly optimistic? Shouldn't we acknowledge that we are in a long-haul struggle? Doesn't making unrealistic predictions discredit our movement?
Yes. A good question, apparently, you know. Prima facie, it seems a good question, but in actual fact, 2012 will happen for the simple reason. Let's take a moon at its darkest phase, you see, when it's absolutely, totally, totally dark. Immediately at that point in time, the new moon is born. Right. So the closer we get to this year, 2012, which is a unique year for our planet, Gaia, the closer, the signs are all there. I mean, there hasn't been so much planetary chaos as today. America had never been attacked before in its cities. I mean, you can see it everywhere. The threat, the Muslim threat, the international manipulators have never been so strong. But at this point in time, there is a resurgence everywhere. Now, the thing is this, you mentioned nationalist groups, and this is our problem. We are, all of us, digging our little furrows in England, in France, in Italy, in Malta here, you see. We have no supervision. We have to sublimate at this point in time our petty nationalisms into a supranationalism. Now, to do that, we need a great idea. And the only idea which can galvanize the whole European race, the fourth cousins, the Anglo-Saxons, the Teutons, the Slavs, and last but not least, the Latins, the only way we can get together is to have this big idea, an idea so strong as to draw everybody together and pluck our heads out of that petty nationalism that has kept us divided for 2,000 years. Now, this is it. The only idea which can do that is Imperium Europa is an imperial idea. Now, Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, anybody who may be aware of him, of your listeners, would know that he was a spiritual man. He didn't talk politics. You don't see in Nietzsche the ways and means to get political power. You never read it in Zarathustra or The Birth of a Tragedy.
Sir?
Excuse me, let me finish this, please, just a bit. You know, I get carried away sometimes, but it's my nature. But in one book alone, Nietzsche descends into the political, and that's The Genealogy of Morals. And he says, now this is 200 years ago, he says, I'm quoting verbatim here, the time for petty politics is over. The very next century will bring the fight for the dominion of the earth, the compulsion to large-scale politics. You see, now here it is, 200 years ago, and this man had the foresight to view nationalism as the very weapon which our enemies will use against us. Nietzsche had this vision of a caste of Superman leading the white race, leading a united Europe, an imperial vision. You see, he hath already this imperial vision. And here we are in 2001, whatever.
2007.
2007, and we are still bickering amongst ourselves. The French against the Germans against the Slavs, the British against everybody else, of course. You see, we've got to get out of this. We have to have a bigger vision. Hence, Imperium Europa.
You know, actually, I was going to say, I had noticed that I'm hearing echoes of Zarathustra everywhere when you talk. I mean, Zarathustra is everywhere in your metaphors.
Yes, yes. Zarathustra gives one the spiritual underpinning for this great venture. You see, you can't find a spiritual underpinning in Christianity. You can't. Christianity is, as Nietzsche says, the revolt of resentment by the slaves. So we can't, no matter what we do, we cannot hold Christianity anymore as our spiritual underpinning. It will not work.
He calls it Shandala morality, right? The untouchables, right?
Exactly. We need to rediscover the nobility, our pre-Christian nobility, aristocratic bearing, our pride, you see, in ourselves. Christianity, unfortunately, over 2,000 years has corroded all that. So we have to do something. Of course, for the masses, it's all right. Christianity can carry on with the masses and whatever they do, but certainly not the future elite who have to save the white man, I mean.
2 years ago in London, you gave a talk at the New Right Conference, and one of the things you said is that it would be fairly easy for a nationalist bloc to arise inside the EU Parliament. You only need 18 members from 5 different countries. And in fact, this has recently happened.
Exactly.
Do you have any involvement? Do you have any involvement with this new nationalist bloc in the EU Parliament?
It's a pity I'm not. It's a pity I'm not amongst that group. You see, we had an election for MEP Parliament in Malta. I got thousands of second preference votes. People, of course, voted to the usual politicians, either the squalid socialists or the Christian hypocrites. You know, two sides of the same coin. But we got thousands. A surprising result here of second preference votes, we call them. And unfortunately, I'm not there. I intend to contest the elections again. I intend to be in Brussels to join this group and infuse it with this Imperium Europa idea. If you notice, already within this group, there are fractures. Why? Because there is no cohesive idea binding them together. It's just a number game. It's like a porcelain Chinese vase, very precious, that has been broken and stuck together with glue, you see. It's all right, it's there, but it's not integrated. It's not the real thing. It's fractured. And that is what this group is at the moment. They need an idea, a great idea, the idea of Imperium.
On a related issue, in Imperium Europa, how much autonomy would the individual nations and peoples have? Could each group safeguard its uniqueness, or would nationalities be submerged within, you know, a mass?
Excellent question. Beautiful. The thing is, it is the present EU which is smothering the individual nations, you see, with thousands and thousands. There are some 100,000 laws in the EU. Nobody's ever read them all, you see. They have departments for every branch. Nobody has an idea of the whole mess they have created, you see, these bureaucrats. So it is this kind of EU which has smothered the individual with all sorts of laws which do not fit the various regions, of course. Imperium Europa will not be an imperium of nation states, you see. It will be an imperium of regions and peoples. The nation states, the borders, will gradually dissolve organically. And the old regions, the Hanoverians, the Burgundy, the Grand Tyrol, Lombardy, you know, all these regions which predate the nation states, which are only 300 years old, you know, at least only 200 years, less than 200 years old, and drawn up by drunken princes and dukes and kings. You see, it's all artificial, this Europe of ours. In the First World War, you had Frenchmen, inverted commas, fighting Germans when they were more German than they were French, you see, this fratricide. And this is what our enemies, of course, use all the time to keep us at each other's throat, our international enemies. So we have to present an international idea to counter this enemy within. Now, Renner, if I may. So in the Imperium, the regions and peoples will come up. There will be one army protecting the whole Imperium, but the regions will have their own police forces, their own laws, their own customs, everything. Nobody will touch them, because that's the Dominion side. We have a two-sided vision, Imperium, Dominion, male and female. The universe is male and female, you see. The planets are male and female. The plants, the animals, our bodies are male and females. Our ears, one is male, the other one is female. Our nostrils, this is the tantric, of course, wisdom. Everything is male and female, including the atom. So in our Imperium, we will have the masculine side, which is the imperial vision, iron hard, diamond pure, and diamond hard, that will only concern itself with five issues. Race, spirituality, territory, and high politics, you know, and high politics. Five untouchable apples in a garden of Eden. All else will be free. We will liberalize everything, not in the modern liberal sense, but in a libertarian. And everybody, each individual, will be answerable to himself. He will have to bear the consequences of his actions. We don't want nanny governments. No, there will be direct competition between the regions, you see, and the regions will not be capable of waging war against each other, because the army will be in the hands of the elite, the Imperium.
Lowell, I think you've just answered a very interesting question, which I was about to ask you. But let me just go over the question and then explain how I think you've answered
please,
it?
Please excuse me for rambling on.
No, not at all.
Sometimes.
You bring up Imperium and Dominium. There's a question that's been submitted here. A reader was curious as to how one can both be a racist and a strong libertarian at the same time, because libertarianism seems to imply a live and let live attitude toward concerns that inform racialism. A strong libertarian would say that miscegenation or immigration were private business. So how do you reconcile these things? Now, I think you've already answered this.
Yes,
it has
of
to
course.
Do with the distinction between Imperium or Dominium.
Exactly.
Your libertarianism it only applies to Dominium.
The libertarianism applies only within the Dominium. So if one would want, for example, Scandinavid would cherish that wonderful, enchanting idea of marrying a Nigerian woman, for example, he would be free to do so. But
like Heidi Klum.
But he will become an automatic outcast, of course. He'll have to leave the Imperium forever, you see. This is it. So we are libertarians within the sealed borders of a planetary Imperium. As I said, there are five items which are untouchable. One of them is race. You can't have millions of aliens seeping in through a porous border and changing our very being, you see. We can't have that, because otherwise everything else will come to naught.
So Imperium trumps Dominium, and race trumps libertarianism. Trumps, you know, like in cards?
Well, libertarianism, yes, I get you. Libertarian, race falls under the Imperium side. That's it. There's no, but the individual will be free to do what he wants. Regarding race, miscegenation, outside the Imperium. In fact, the Imperium will be an Imperium for Europeans only. That's it. We will have to draw the lines, you see.
Alistair Clark, who I know asked a question at your 2005 talk, you might remember him.
Yes, wonderful, yes.
He would like to know if your economic ideas have changed since you wrote Credo 20 years ago, especially with reference to global warming.
Yes, my ideas regarding economics, you see, are still libertarian. We will allow the free market to reign. In that way, the regions will find their own niche. We will not have duplication of production. For example, an aircraft industry in France, in Germany, in Italy, in England, all competing amongst themselves for squalid contracts with the Muslim world. That will not happen, you see. Why? Because within an imperium, the market will sort itself out, and we will have economies of scale. Now, globalization is ruining the white man because we can't compete with the massed battalions, the alien billions of the third world. We can't do that. I've said this before in London and everywhere. So we have to create, the only answer are sealed borders within a planetary imperium. That means a market of 1 billion whites, the most cultured, the most evolved, most intelligent part of humanity. What a market. What else does the businessman want, you see? We will, in our imperium, high politics is, again, one of those untouchable apples. In our imperium, foreign high politics falls within the realm of the imperium. So the businessman will not be able to set up a business just across the border in Mexico to avail himself of lower wage. He would not. He could, but he'll have to stay in Mexico forever. He'll be an outcast, never to come in again. This is it. We will cut off this nonsense, this pitting the white man against the alien billion. So even here in the economic sphere, high politics, we will only trade our food surpluses with the rest of the world. That's the imperium's economic policy with the outside world. we will trade our food surpluses, because no other race other than the white race can produce a food surplus. We can starve the rest within a very short time. That is our weapon. Not cluster bombs, not nuclear weapons, but food. They have to eat. They can't eat their oil, damn it. So we can coerce everybody to do exactly as what we want them to do through our weapon of food. But you have to have a common foreign policy. You have to have an elite. You have to have an imperium. As regards to global warming, environment, of course, will be at high priority within the imperium. Crimes against the environment will be held as crimes against the imperium, punishable by severe sentences with hard labor, not only to the middle management, but to those bloated, cigar-puffing board of directors themselves. We will get them into shape, you see.
That's certainly an interesting picture. In his book on fascism, Roger Griffin, I believe he's an English academic,
yeah.
He repeatedly and snidely characterizes fascists as having certain delusional traits of heightened unrealism. These fascists, according to Griffin, are always on the brink of power, in their opinion, always on the cusp of a new era, even when their group consists of half a dozen men standing on a street corner holding up handmade signs. Griffin repeatedly gives examples of failed fascists who believed they were on the verge of a new order and who inevitably failed. Apparently, Mussolini and Hitler were short-term exceptions to his mocking rule.
Oh,
now, this is a longer question. Let me go here.
Yeah.
You have your adherents. That's great.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You didn't do so well in the election. You've repeatedly been brought up for criminal prosecution just for exercising free speech. And apparently, illegal immigrants to Malta have more rights than you do. The situation in Europe as a whole and the whole world is not really better. Perhaps less bombastic talk of Imperium Europa and international rodents and year one in 2012 could be, and more realistic assessment of the need to set up long-term structures, recruit cadres, and like moles, infiltrate the structure of the globalist establishment. Maybe that would be better. Now, in the modern era, the TV era, cool rhetoric makes more of a positive impression than hot rhetoric. I think this is from McLuhan somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not, it's not that you should change your message, but how the message is packaged and presented. My summation of this question would be, in other words, perhaps you should get yourself up as a sheep with a bell to lead the other sheep and drop the wolf act. Are you as concerned with your people as you are with your ego?
Well, you see, first of all, this ego business, you see, hardly has anything to do with it. I mean, I saw my country. I witnessed the crucifixion of Rhodesia. I was in Rhodesia twice for extended periods during Ian Smith's regime, and I saw a beautiful country, a peaceful country, first declared as an enemy of the world by the United Nations, the most peaceful country on earth, and then I witnessed the crucifixion of Rhodesia with Kissinger as the hangman, of course. He was behind it all, always. So I vowed when I was there, a young man, there are photos of this and on
yes,
our
I've
website, vivamalta.org, yes.
May I mention, as it's doing very poorly now, what's now called Zimbabwe. It's doing
course,
even worse.
Yes, the situation is really black over there. Anyway, the thing is, I was there, and I vowed that the same thing would never happen to Malta, you know. We seemed so safe and so on, and exactly the same thing is happening. Exactly the same forces. We don't have Henry Kissinger here, but we get all these international busybodies, all, of course, from the same tribe, coming over to Malta, telling us what to do, that we have to open the doors and welcome these, and the rest of it. So, I am a voice. I am like that guard dog on the roof in a farmstead, you see, barking, trying to wake up the farmer and his family who are sound asleep while their barns are being robbed. So the dog has to howl and bark.
Right. If he dresses up like a sheep, it's not going to do anything.
Exactly. So we have to bark. Our message to get through has to be a certain message, a certain toughness, a certain brutality even. But we've got to, and we did. In the very short time here, we've outpaced the Greens, for example, as a political force. We are the only opposition in Malta. The very fact that the whole media, all the TV stations here, bombard Imperium Europa and Viva Malta, clearly demonstrates that we are not a joke anymore. We are not. We are the only real opposition on the island. We are those 300 Spartans who have drawn a line on the sand and said the enemy shall not pass.
Very interesting. Can I ask you to answer the next question with reference to Evola's Apolitia?
Yes.
and to Zarathustra in his
yes.
modern cave?
Yes.
Can artists and intellectuals afford to withdraw from the world in order to do their work under present conditions?
Excellent. Look, the New Testament recounts an episode where the apostles are with Jesus Christ up on a mountaintop and they had this transcendental experience. It was so beautiful that these 12 followers asked their leader, "Why don't we build up a few huts here and stand here? And stay up here in the mountain air, live away from those poisonous flies and the marketplace and all that, you see." The allure to this vision is very profound. I know people in Malta who are much better qualified to lead the right wing, but they're not interested. They found the comfort zone. They train to ensure the martial arts or whatever they do, or they're in some yoga circle, and they have absconded. They have abdicated. They don't want to know. So, the vision, the transcendental vision of Evola and Zarathustra and Nietzsche are all well and good. But as the sun rises, you see, one has to get back to the valley, to go down to the valley, to plow the fields, to prune the trees, and so on. There's work to be done, hard work. Otherwise, the valley will be taken over by thugs, by scoundrels.
Right, the trees aren't going to prune themselves, you say.
Exactly. We have to go down, you see, to the valley. We have to. We can't live with Evola. The Evola retreated. He was not even a member of the post-fascist parties. You know, he never even became a member of MSI, the Movimento Sociale. They used to hold pilgrimages to his house. I know where he lived, just behind the monument there in Rome, the white cake, the wedding cake, we call it. He had a lovely palace just behind that. You see, but he was a recluse. But he doesn't tell you how to garner power. All he did, Evola, was said, all he said in political actuality was, let's get out of the United Nations. That is all. Otherwise, it was all idea. All ideas, airy-fairy. All right, you need division. You need division. But, come on, you need the political soldiers. And this is the problem with the new right. And I said it in London, and I will say it again whenever I'm invited anywhere. We have to turn this vision of ours, these great ideas, because we're far ahead, the new right, it's far ahead of everybody else. But we have to translate all this into political clout, into political currency. And that is the problem, you see. Here in Malta, we are doing our best as we think fit. We will be celebrating here in a few days on the 9th, our anniversary. A lot of us will gather and so on, and this is it. We have to galvanize the people, open their eyes to this nightmarish future which is awaiting them very soon, you see. And this is it. This is it. We have to go down to the valley. We can't stay on the mountaintop with Evola and Nietzsche. We can't.
Well, Zarathustra opens with Zarathustra going back to the valley.
Yes, it did. Yes, true.
Do you foresee a schism between diaspora and Israeli Jewry via the hard right, white nationalism, Israeli apartheid, etc.? I understand that there are a lot of divisions in Israel itself. For instance, apparently the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, and the secular Israelis absolutely loathe one another.
Yes.
But that's not the schism I'm asking about. Diaspora and Israeli Jewry. Will there be a schism?
No, there will never be a schism. In the end, in the final analysis, you will find them together. Always. It has always been so, and it will remain so. A Jew is a Jew is a Jew.
Okay. What are the chances for a blood and soil European Union revolution?
I didn't quite understand the question, Renner.
I don't either. I didn't write it. let me try this one. Would you care to explore the possibilities for international cooperation, including transatlantic, between potential blood and soil European states and multiracial states of European origin? I think, yes, this is asking, suppose there is the Imperium Europa, the beginning of it in Europe.
Yes.
And then there are other Europe,
yes,
majority European states,
yes,
in other parts of the world, but that are multiracial.
Yes.
How will that play out?
Yes, it would play out through our food weapon, you see. The Imperium will stretch from the Emerald Isle, Ireland, to Vladivostok, across the Bering Strait with a tunnel under the ice there to link up Siberia, the heartland, the telluric world island, as we call it, with Vinland, with America, the new America, Vinland, Alaska, Canada, and the present Jewish-dominated USA. So we will have that tunnel, which Stalin actually built one between Russia and Sakhalin, you see, the island of Sakhalin, the Japanese Kuril Islands there. No, the Japanese, you know, former Japanese Sakhalin. So he did it under the ice. So if Stalin, with a communist creaking economy, could do that, we could do even better. So we link up the telluric with the Atlantis, with America. So an imperium from the Channel to Vladivostok across the Bering Straits, uniting Vinland. Then we have huge swathes of land in South America. I call it the white cone there. Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, and all that. And through our food creating capacity, as I mean, the blacks in Brazil, they're in Havana, have favelas or whatever. They're not plowing fields. They're not producing agricultural goods. They're just there, you know, in the cities. So it's very, very easy to take control just by defending the food-producing areas of the globe. Then there's Australia. A short, sharp repatriation program will clear it of all the non-Europeans there. And there's South Africa, empty, waiting. Africa is empty. Anybody who goes to Africa and travels with a car realizes the emptiness of the continent. I have a friend, a South African friend, who lives in Port Elizabeth, who comes over to Malta every year religiously because of our temples and whatnot, you see. He comes here, does pilgrimage. And he tells me, Norman, Malta is far larger, far greater than South Africa. It's vast, Malta. He means that if you drive from Johannesburg to Cape Town, there's nothing, there's only Karoo. The same landscape, nothing. In Malta, every 100 yards, there's a temple, a Roman temple, Carthaginian, Punic, Phoenician, you name it.
Right, you were speaking of pagan temples and not of...
Yes.
This is not a Catholic pilgrimage.
No, not a Catholic,
okay.
No. No, we have many of those as well. So you see, this is it. Malta's vast in that sense, in a spiritual, cultural sense. So Africa's empty, empty. All the whites have to do in Africa is just defend the food-producing areas, and that's it. They have everybody to their mercy, you see? It is so simple, damn it. So we'll have to go back and go and clean up to the Zambezi. So there you have two white rings encircling the globe. And we can survive for millennia. But that's not enough, of course. We will start terraforming Mars and so on. It can be done. We already have the knowledge and the scientific thing. And not only that, our ideas are far ahead, you see. All those sarcophagus of the Greek, the Hellenic kings and philosophers, we have them through DNA and genetic engineering or whatnot. We can recreate, we can resurrect that nobility and infuse it with our best, highest IQ people living today. We can create the Übermensch of whom Nietzsche spoke. Now, what kind of future Europe this would be, whether it will be the blonde beast or the Italian lover, well, we'll have to discuss that later, you see. But do you understand me? We have the corpses of the kings, of the Hellenic kings. We have the Spartan kings. We have the Spartan soldiers. We can resurrect those people through our genius, through the genius of the white man, and infuse them with the best we have today, and create the new elite, you see, that those 2 million people who will be the guardians of the farmstead. Hello?
Yes, I'm just thinking. What would you... Are there any other... turning to a lighter note for a second. What would you say about Malta to people who don't know much about Malta to persuade them to visit? I believe this question comes from someone who is half English and half Maltese.
Yes. Malta, just 50 years ago, was a paradise. I know an old lady who passed away about 15 years ago. Blackley, her name was, English woman, who used to tell me, she ran a toffee shop, you know, these confectionaries in Valletta. And she told me, Norman, when I first landed in Malta in 1947, I thought I landed in paradise. And I believed her. Malta was a paradise. Lord Mountbatten used to come here in incognito and swim in our clean waters, clear blue Mediterranean. The island was a gem of tranquility. And in 40 years, through greed, through bad politics, we have turned it into a dustbin, you see. And people blame the contractors, the building contractors and so on, for building haphazardly, choking valleys with concrete, spoiling skylines and all that. But really, it's the politicians who have done this damage. And the contractors, the businessman, adapts himself to the political situation. If the politician is corrupt, the businessman will corrupt him. Why not? Otherwise, somebody else will do it. It's not the businessman who ruined Malta. It's our politicians. Those fools in parliament who have placed there because we did not descend into the valley. And we let those fools take over, you see. And we've ruined this island. But I've swore that we will begin the reconstruction or deconstruction of our island and take it back to its original pristine beauty, you see. We will clean up the mess. And if I am in Europe, it will be much easier because we will get European help to turn this island as it was in the 1800s. Olive trees all around, a sky-high city in the center there, and the island a vast garden dotted with prehistoric monuments and temples. This is our vision.
What is the highest elevation above sea level in Malta?
Oh, you've got me there. I've only been here 60 years. I never considered that. I think so. I'm not sure, a few hundred, I don't know, a few hundred feet, I must profess my ignorance here.
Probably. There's no mountain.
No, just hills. The Malta is the sheer cliffs on one side and gentle beaches on the other. You see, it's tilted one way.
You call Malta the Sacred Isle of Melita, which doesn't... Does Melita mean honey, or am I thinking of a
Melite.
Greek word?
Actually, the word is Melite. It is honey, the island of honey, overflowing with honey. Thing is, Malta has always been a spiritual focal point. In the pharaohs, for example, in Egypt, the pharaohs, their vision of paradise, of Elysium, where those islands to the west, those islands... the abode of the gods. You see, the Egyptians...
Where the sun sets.
Yes, the Egyptians, you see, always had this vision of sailing to our islands to rest with the gods. So Malta was always, and even pre-pharaonic Malta, you see, we haven't even excavated the scores of temples that lie buried under mountains of concrete here. So when we do, Malta could have the DNA, the genetic diary of the European race, with remains here dating at least 24,000 years, predating everybody else. We have the first freestanding temples here, but more than that, we have secrets buried under the island here, which will reveal the genetic composition, the proto-Mediterranean, the proto-European, if you get what I mean. You see, we were the very first here, at the very center of the cradle of European civilization. I mean to establish a university here, which will be the focal point for all Europeans within the Imperium to come and study here the origins, the spiritual origins of our race in Malta here.
The surname Lowell is unusual for Malta. Do you have an English patrilineage? What's the history of the Lowells? How did you arrive in Malta?
Well, the Lowells were, before they were Lovett or Lovell or something like that. And then they went to a rich family
in
from
England.
Staffordshire. Yes, in England, Staffordshire farmers, very rich, and this Percival Lowell went to America with his family and retinue of servants, Percival Lowell, and his two children changed their names to Lowell to denote the cut, you see. And from that one family, from those two sons, the Lowell family, as it is spelled today, L-O-W-E-L-L, spread throughout the world. I have some cousins in Puerto Rico, everywhere. So my father's grandfather was Albert Lowell. He was British, a professor at Nantes University in France. He taught English there, came to Malta and stayed here, married and so on. My direct grandma, my father's mother, Elizabeth, was actually British as well, Elizabeth Hampton. So I have an English side to my family, as well as an Italian side. As well as an Italian side. My great-grandmother was Venetian. She spoke dialetto veneziano, which is incomprehensible even to Italians, you know. My father says that when she flew into a temper, nobody could understand her. So, you know, I'm in a sense, I represent this beautiful symmetry, this beautiful amalgamation of the European race, you see. The Latins with their genius for music, Rossini, they gave us everything, the Italians. The British with their mathematics and science and fair play. And so you see the Slavs with their seriousness and spirituality. The Germans with their managerial prowess. We can rule the world if only we get together. But we need an idea, Imperium. Okay.
Thank you, Lowell.
Bye-bye then, all of you.